You've just had a going over that would put any psychiatrist to shame, he remarked with a trace of a laugh in his voice. Is it something like psychoanalysis? I asked. Yes, you could say that. But it is far superior. Psychiatrists touch only surface conditions, while these probes go much deeper into individuals' makeups. In fact, while that disc was the near you, it gathered an entire summation of all the lives of your particular soul. But there is one thing it can't tell us, and with the last remark he was pensive. What is that? Man has free will. The pattern of his emotions and thoughts and consequent future actions are subject to change. No, Howard, our pretty little light is not infallible. Near the ship we halted. I desperately wanted to go inside, but managed to control my desire to ask. Instead, I surreptitiously tried to send a strong, mental impression to him indicating my wishes, while trying not to show edginess in my face. He smiled at my thoughts and told me they did not have the time now and that I would need certain processing before entering one of the ships. Often at parting I had the desire to go with them and leave this planet, though I realized that was not their plan for me. We shook hands and as usual I was advised I would be contacted again very soon. As he prepared to enter, he told me to step back at least 50 feet, and I complied. Once he was inside, the craft rose vertically, and when, as usual, it was about 100 feet off the ground, there was a flash of light and it disappeared. While returning home I wondered how I would be able to continue keeping secret all of the wonderful things which were happening to me. Surely someone must have seen the lights during my many contacts. Someone could have been in the woods and seen the whole thing. I could be certain, however, that only one witness besides myself had seen it all, and that was my dog, Tassie, which had been with us all the time. I remember how at one time my friend bent down and petted Tassie and said she was a fine dog. Now, Tassie, however, had taken this all in stride, and had run off through the bushes after a rabbit. 12. The story leaks out. I sent my film to the processor with misgivings, fearing someone would notice what was on it and grow curious. I had thought of having a friend do the work, but he would be even more likely to look the pictures over closely. I somewhat breathlessly waited for the prints to be returned. But my fears were groundless and I was somewhat disappointed to see that only one picture was fairly good, the shot showing the men in front of the craft. The prints showed very little detail. The shape of the craft was greatly distorted, and the man showed only as a dark silhouette without the contour of his fine body showing through the uniform. Instead of being beautiful as I had hoped, the picture was grotesque. Then a dreadful thought went through my mind and I chilled. These pictures must have been duplicated and faked to resemble the pictures I had taken. Though in spite of the fact that I sincerely believed the pictures had been cleverly faked duplicates of the originals, refusing to remember, in my disappointment, what my friend had said about the field radiation around the craft, I nevertheless showed them to my family and a few friends. The next day I went to the small processing lab and asked the owner if he had made up the pictures. He admitted he had not. He had been very busy and had farmed them out, along with some other work, to a friend. I was still quite suspicious, yet I made no accusations. My real point of frustration came when I tried to convince my father of what he had seen. In spite of the visual proof I offered, which, of course, wasn't good, he remained skeptical. Because some people thought the pictures had been faked, and to conquer my own misgivings about the photographer, I decided to buy a Polaroid camera which would develop and print pictures within a minute, right inside it. One person in whom I confided believed me. That was Bill. It was indeed gratifying to make some progress at what seemed to be a hopeless and discouraging task. I purchased a second-hand Polaroid camera and patiently awaited another opportunity to take more pictures. I did not have to wait very long, for on a night shortly thereafter I again received a telepathic communication to come to field location number 1. It was 12:45 a.m., August 2, 1956, a sultry summer night. The heavy air was pierced by the chirping of crickets as I stood by my car with the camera poised, looking upward and hoping for a chance at some good pictures. Surely enough, over the west side of the field I soon saw a craft sliding noiselessly through the dark sky in an easterly direction, appearing as a bluish-white blob of light. The closer it approached, the brighter it became. Finally, when it was within 100 feet of me, it slowly descended and hovered about 2 feet from the ground. I snapped away, hardly able to wait for even a minute while the pictures developed, but in the darkness could not see just how I was doing. I noticed one of the three ball-like objects under the craft became distorted and looked like rubber as it seemed to stretch and grasp the ground. I could see the other two balls through the translucent flange. I wondered how they could make metal appear translucent, and also become plastic, certainly alien to our earthly physics. Portals in sets of three then appeared around the dome. An opening appeared and a man stepped out. He stood tall and straight, his long, blonde hair blowing in the soft warm summer breeze. I could see the beautiful structure of his body, his broad shoulders, slim waist, and long, straight legs. His ski-type uniform covered his entire body, exposing only his head and hands. He approached and when he was about 50 feet away I snapped his picture. He, like the other man, was silhouetted against the glowing craft, a dramatic pose which I hoped would turn out better than my previous picture. But in the picture the craft seemed distorted and looked as if a gaseous, swirling haze encircled it. As I had raised the camera he had paused, then he walked forward to meet me and as we greeted each other again I had that pleasant feeling of warmth and love coming from him to me. I hope these pictures will help you in the future, even though they may be slightly distorted, due to the electromagnetic flux around the craft. I then realized the first pictures had not been faked and I felt ashamed of how I approached the photographer so suspiciously. It is not the fault of the film nor the developing process, he added, it's just that the film doesn't see things exactly the same way your eyes pick them up. He suggested that I try to get a good shot of the craft taking off when I left, and promised that I could take more pictures the following night at field location number 2. He told me I would receive either a telepathic message or a direct telephone call, but in the event of the latter, gave me a code word to identify the contact so I would know it wasn't a hoax. Your story is getting around, so prepare yourself for pranksters, he admonished. At the same time he gave me names of possible witnesses who would come into the plan. One was a student physicist studying in Princeton University who had been under their observations for a number of years. The other was a friend of this man, who lived in Washington, New Jersey, and who was described to me as a brilliant high school student. Both individuals, he said, were highly evolved people who conceivably could help if it were their desires. Since there was to be no force or persuasion attached to the work, it would be on a volunteer basis and completely of their own volition. The high school student would be instrumental in introducing me to the university student and both probably would be present as witnesses in the near future. My contacts would now be speeded up, and I would have many witnesses. Hundreds of people would come to me and I would be much in the public eye. Nonetheless, I was counseled to exercise wisdom and perfect control over situations which would come up. He also told me that within a short time I would meet a very highly evolved being, a great instructor from one of their advanced civilizations on another planet. Then he changed the subject. He knew I had been worried about how I had revealed some of the information I should have withheld. You are inexperienced, and, anyway, the proper time for revealing it is almost here, so little harm has been done. He wished me luck and stepped back into the craft. As it took off, I was able to get 2 successful shots of it. As I went home, I was lost in a sea of thoughts. Although breaking the story would further explain my unusual hours to my family, how could I get this story across to the people? Why was I chosen to do this? I felt inadequate, helpless. The story had jumped the gun by 8 months because my wife had become perturbed about my getting up and leaving at strange hours of the night. To ease her concern, I finally had to show her and the immediate family the pictures I had taken, and then, of course, tell them something of what I was doing. Thus, due to conditions perhaps beyond my control, the story did get out before the appointed time. This worried me, for I had been forewarned of the repercussions which lay ahead. 13. Anti-magnetic field. This should be one of the most interesting chapters in this book, but in reading over the rough draft I made of it, I have to write something 3 or 4 times before I'm able to get most of the grammatical kinks out of it. Anthony, it is not great literature as you have found out. I found it was impossible to describe the feelings I had when I first entered one of the spacecraft. Somehow, when that great moment arrived, the overwhelming stimulus made my mind flee from it, and instead of looking over the ship, as I should have, I seemed to develop, instead, a fixation about why my watch had stopped. In fact, it was almost as unnerving as my first television appearance. But to get the cart behind the horse, I should say it was about midnight the following night when I received the telephone call. A man's voice first gave the code word we had agreed upon and advised me to get up to field location number 1 as soon as possible. Before hanging up, he said there would be another call on the 4th of August. I arrived at the field just in time to see a small spacecraft descending slowly. The brightness diminished and the color changed to a deep blue violet and then almost disappeared. It landed about 50 feet from me, and for the first time I heard a sound when one of these ships hit the ground. On the ground it appeared as a dark hulk with no reflecting lights on it, only a soft, bluish, white light emanating from the portholes. From one side of the craft a brilliant light shot out and I could see the outline of a tall man in the opening. He emerged from the craft and walked toward me as another man appeared in the opening, waiting. As the first man reached my side he greeted me, "Howard, did you get a good picture?" I had been so fascinated by the landing I had simply forgotten to take pictures, so, embarrassed, I grabbed the camera and snapped some shots. Apparently they were trying to cooperate with me and were anxious that I get some good clear pictures, realizing how difficult it was to photograph their craft. Then I received a tremendous surprise. In a very matter-of-fact manner the man remarked, "We don't have much time, Howard, so come on and we'll make a quick trip to field location number 2. He turned, as if to indicate I should follow him to the craft. In my surprise I just stood there, with, I am afraid, a wild stare of wonderment in my eyes. "Just a second," he said, as if I had already started to walk with him, and he motioned to the second man, who stepped outside and raised his arm. In his hand was some sort of instrument which he pointed at me. Suddenly a bluish beam shot out at me, and as it struck my head I felt a tingling sensation, warm, and rather pleasant. I stood in my tracks as he slowly played the beam downward over my body until it had reached my feet. Then he turned it off, and my friend threw up his arm, indicating that I walk ahead of him. The other man had stepped into the craft and now beckoned me. I walked up to the ship and through the opening, which closed behind us. I was almost stunned. Surrounded by the strangeness of the inside, my attention must have simply retreated to the familiar, for I remember looking at my watch and regarding the face of it in an inordinately close manner. The watch said 12:45. It had stopped, for the second hand was not moving. I shook it and put it to my ear. Then the hand began to move and I could hear ticking. The man who had stayed with the ship was at a strange instrument panel. I noticed he was watching my performance with the watch with some amusement, for he grinned. At that moment the walls became brighter, as if illuminated somehow from inside themselves, and I felt a sudden jerk. I assumed we had left the ground, though I could feel no movement. One moment later I felt another jerk and the opening appeared again in the wall. "Here we are," said the man who had come out to meet me. My friends stepped out first and I followed. Again I was amazed. There, etched against the sky, was the drill landmark I had grown to know so well. We were at field location number 2! The craft was now flat down on the ground, dark and obscure, and probably impossible to see from any distance. The night was very dark, and the only light was a beacon, about 5 miles away, which flashed on and off. The neighboring farmhouses were dark and silent, and the only noise was the intermittent barking of some farmer's dog in the far distance. Recovering from my surprise and wonderment at my first ride, I first asked about the bluish beam they had projected on me, then why the jerk when we took off, why my watch had stopped. Then almost before they could answer, my pent-up mind let go with a dozen more questions. My friends just laughed, and one of them said they would try to answer all my questions if I would give them time. The trip, he explained, was an experimental one, to determine if it were possible to take pictures of the craft within its flux area, then get into the craft with the camera, then take more pictures without ill effects upon the film. I was flattered when they explained they had rigged this craft especially for me, having installed special accessory instruments which they hoped would prevent the magnetizing effects and the radiation which often ruin films, magnetize our watches and affected our electrical equipment. I mentioned I thought my watch had stopped when we entered the craft, and he said it had indeed. When the man at the instrument panel had pushed a certain button, however, the magnetic condition had been nullified. That was why my watch started again. He hoped the new instruments would remedy the magnetic conditions which affected cameras and other equipment and possibly could do physical harm. Now for your first question, he continued. We projected the beam on you to condition and process your body quickly so you could enter the craft. What actually happened was that the beam changed your body frequency to equal that of the craft. Thus you felt entirely comfortable inside the craft and suffered no ill effects. Tell me, Howard, the other man asked, did you have a burning sensation when the beam hit you? No, I replied. It felt warm, and it rather felt good. Excellent, said the other. Had this beam hit you before you knew of us and our craft, your fear would have caused a chemical reaction with the ray which would have in turn caused a hot or burning sensation. It wouldn't have hurt you, but it would have been mighty uncomfortable. I then understood one of the reasons why they approached Earth people so carefully. Fear must be one of the emotions they must eliminate before they can safely approach us. Fear probably could cause an Earthman harm. Then he understood a good definition of fear. Fear was the absence of love and trust. When they apparently felt they had answered enough questions, they suggested I try more pictures of the craft. I felt they were actually enjoying the picture taking and that their insistence about it was made half for their own enjoyment. As they walked eagerly to the craft, entered and took it off the ground, I was reminded of my own small son's eagerness when we often took pictures at home. The ship rose about 25 feet off the ground and headed in a westerly direction for about 1,000 yards. I snapped several pictures of it, and when they returned I showed them the prints. They examined them carefully, as one of them reached for the little brush which comes with the film and rubbed the picture with it to preserve it. It was evident that their new equipment had been successful, for the film had not been damaged. But they shook their heads. The pictures were still not very clear, and they said their equipment needed further adjustments. I wondered why all the fuss about my taking pictures when they, themselves, must have far better cameras. I asked about it. The two men looked at each other and smiled. One of them reached somewhere inside the ski-type uniform, though I could see no pocket nor opening, and withdrew something shiny which he held in the palm of his hand. He then opened his hand slowly and indicated I should look. As quickly as I had seen a flash of what he held, he closed his hand and put the thing back inside his uniform, presumably into some pocket. In a brief instant I had regarded what for loss of words I shall call a picture, but which is impossible to describe. It was of some scene with much green and blue sky and fantastic buildings. It was more than a picture. It was self-illuminated and was like looking more through a window at a real three-dimensional scene than at a flat object. You wouldn't want to scare them to death, now, would you, Howard? What would your grandfather have said had he walked suddenly into a room where a television set was turned on? I didn't ask any further questions about their cameras. They indicated we should leave, and in another unbelievably short period we were back at field location number one. As they bid me goodbye, they said I would be taking another trip soon, a much longer one. They sensed the curiosity in my mind, though it was, I am certain, evident on my face, and one of them simply pointed at the horizon where a light of some sort was beginning to show. Not catching the meaning, I waved as they re-entered the craft, which hovered over my car for a few moments, then sped away to the west. I turned the key and tried to start the engine, but it would not turn over. I thought my battery must be dead, or a terminal unhooked. Throwing back the hood, I checked the terminals, but they were tight. I unscrewed one of the filler caps, and steam gushed from the opening. I felt the battery and discovered it was very warm. I got back into the car and tried the starter again. It responded and the engine started. Then I figured the proximity of the craft had affected the electrical system, as I remembered some of their previous statements. I made a mental note to ask my friends about it the next time I saw them. I pulled out of the field and hit the main road. As I entered the highway, I again noticed the light at the horizon, which, because of my different position, had turned into a bright moon. It floated in a sea of clouds, and I remembered the trick they had mentioned. As they pointed toward the light at the horizon, did they mean to indicate that? It was almost too exciting to believe. 14. A curious round table. I stayed up very late on the 4th, waiting for the promised phone call. It did not come, so I went to bed about 2 a.m. and almost instantly fell asleep. The next morning I awoke disappointed and wondered if I had been too sleepy to hear the ringing. Feeling the plans had been changed, I went to bed the next night rather early, but was awakened by the jangling of the phone. Howard, is it possible for you to make it tonight to field location number one? There is a possibility you can take some good pictures, though I sensed he had something more important in mind. Give me a few minutes, I replied eagerly. Just a minute, he said. Hello. Hello. I'm still here. Howard, listen to this carefully. Wear dark trousers and shirt. Don't bring any flashlight. Don't drive up to the location, but walk. I understand, I told him. Okay, I'll meet you there. I'm calling from the Fountain Motel. At that time I did not know the location of the motel, which I later found was on Route 22 near Clinton, and which figured in later contacts. I dressed in dark clothing as quickly as possible, understanding why he had made the unusual requests. Neighbors, hearing a trace of my story, were becoming more curious about my nocturnal activities. One of them had stayed up all night, observing me from a darkened window, I heard later. They didn't believe what they had heard about my meetings, instead they suspected I was up to some mischief. Their curiosity and mistrust made my work more difficult, and the resulting caution and secrecy I was forced to use gave my actions even more of an aura of mystery and intrigue. My position was becoming more and more uncomfortable. I felt somewhat like a thief as I slipped into the pitch black night with Tassie, eager to go on another adventure, at my heels. She was a smart dog and knew she must follow me noiselessly as I climbed the steep hill to the rear of the house. Once in the open field, Tass took the lead as I struggled to follow her through the thick underbrush. We came to the wire fence which separated the steep hill from the contact area and crawled through an opening. Once through the fence, I stopped a moment and waited. I couldn't see much of anything in the blackness, but could note that Tass ran ahead to the west end of the field, stopped and looked back to see if I was following, then sat down and waited for me to catch up. Then a ball of light appeared over the hills to the west, moving in our direction at a very slow rate of speed. I took a picture of it, Tass looked in the direction of the oncoming craft, wagging her tail. When it hovered over the crest of the hills, I snapped another picture. It came in close and moved slowly as if trying to help me obtain clear pictures. When it was almost overhead, I could see its undercarriage and snapped a third picture with a prayer that it would come out. The craft landed, as Tass looked in its direction, whining. When the pulsation had subsided, it was almost invisible to sight. Anyone coming into the field at that time would have sworn there was nothing there, least of all a spacecraft. An opening appeared and a bluish, white light spread a path across the field and cast our shadows to the rear of us. A man's frame appeared in the doorway and beckoned to me. I yelled, "Come back here, Tass!" as the dog ran yelping toward the ship. I was afraid the radiation from the ship would harm her. But she stopped short off the entrance, and by the time the man had stepped outside, had knelt down, and was petting her. As I walked toward them, I could see that Tass was wagging her tail vigorously and whimpering with joy. Then I recognized our old friend who had made over her at the previous meeting. The blonde, Aryan-type man looked up. "Hello, Howard. Glad to see you again. Come inside." I followed him and he turned to the dog and admonished, "You be a good dog and stay right there." Tass acted as if she understood perfectly, sat down and watched us quizzically. We stepped into a large circular room. In the center of it was an ample-sized round table made of translucent material. Under the tabletop, pulsating lights of many colors moved. The dowel-shaped stem supporting the table was set in what appeared to be a huge magnifying lens, itself set into the floor. Approximately one-third of the circular room was devoted to instrument panels containing many colored lights blinking on and off. In front of the control board was a frame containing what I guessed was some sort of viewing screen. A man at the control board was listening intently to what I supposed was a message coming from somewhere on the instrument panel. I couldn't understand the words, for the language was unfamiliar. Another man next to the operator was dividing his attention between the incoming message and our entrance into the ship. The two dark-haired men smiled and waved at us, then went back to their business, as I looked around me in amazement. The blonde man waved his hand over a section of the table and two of the lights stopped pulsating and two chairs came out of the floor. "Have a seat," he offered. I asked him if the voice I heard coming in over their radio was from another planet. "No," he explained, "it was coming from another part of my own planet. They were contacting people all over the world and were in constant communication with their various points of contact. He said they could pick up pictures from any of the contact points on their screen, which looked something like a television screen, though perfectly square about 2 feet wide." At that moment the man at the controls looked at me, then at the screen, indicating I should watch it. A picture appeared and the voices changed from foreign tongue to English. I saw a tall, blonde man in a space suit talking to a man with a cowboy hat and dressed in a business suit. The blonde man turned, looked right at me, smiled and waved. I was nonplussed. How was it conceivable that the man on the screen could see us or know of our presence or know he was beamed in or being observed? The surprise was overwhelming, and no one explained it at the moment. The man in the business suit appeared to be confused and uncertain as he kept looking around the craft in which they were conversing. Later I was told the fellow was a rich oil man from Abilene, Texas, who had been contacted by one of their people. His reaction was similar, they said, to all of us experiencing our first contact with people from other planets. The picture vanished, and as I opened my mouth to ask questions, one of the dark-haired men moved over and joined us. I noticed his hair was held in place by a headband similar to the ones our American Indians wore. As a matter of fact, had he worn a feather in the headband, he could have passed for an Indian. "Fellows," I told them, "I'm speechless," then went right ahead rattling off questions. Most of my queries they answered directly, others they politely ignored or led the subject away from them. I had learned never to press them when they chose not to answer. Some of the information they gave me was quite technical, and I wished I had a tape recorder with me instead of trying to rely on my memory. It wouldn't work on board this craft, the blond man said, picking up my thoughts. All you would hear on the tape would be a hiss.